I'm Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, and it's Friday, March 25th, 2011. I thought I'd talk to you today about the radiation that's being emitted from the Fukushima plant. There's a lot of confusing terms out there, and I was hoping to clarify some of them. On the news, you're going to hear about the radiation levels over Tokyo were 1,600 times normal, or that the radioactive concentration of iodine is 5 times what the legal limit is. And I wanted to talk about this. There's a couple different concepts in play here that are worth bringing up. First off, when uranium splits, it makes daughter products. These are daughter products, and they split too. They'll decay away, and in the process of decaying, it's called disintegration, they can emit 3 different things. They can emit a gamma ray, they can emit a beta particle, or they can emit an alpha particle. So there's 3 different kinds of radioactive decay that results from disintegration of these radioactive daughter products. Radiation really means that energy is given up. When this particle decays away, it gives up energy. Well, where does that energy go? It gets absorbed by your body. And that can cause some cellular damage and potentially cancer, especially in fast-growing cells of children. Well, the first kind of radiation that comes out of a nuclear power plant is gamma rays. And they're a high energy, like an X-ray, but even more powerful than an X-ray. And they're what's picked up on the decimeters that you can see different news anchors using when they're out in the field. I brought my Geiger counter with me, and I can show you a little bit about what gamma rays really are. And this is a Geiger counter. It's an oldie but a goodie. And you'll see that the dial is reading about 600 disintegrations per minute here in Vermont. Now, that's not coming from Fukushima, that's coming from the sky, from solar radiation, it's coming from the ground, from radon gases, and other things. Now, those gamma rays are penetrating this metal shell, and inside here is a detector. Now, I brought my grandfather's old radium dial watch, and I'll put it up against the detector, and you'll see the dial go up about 5, 6, 7 times normal background. That's because the radium in this watch is emitting gamma rays that penetrate that. This is why they don't make these watches anymore. People would fall asleep by their brain, and it's not a good thing. But that's an example of a gamma ray. Now, in the news, you'll be reading about over Tokyo, the radiation levels went up. And what that means is that a cloud of radioactive daughter products, usually xenon and krypton, will pass over Tokyo, and they'll create gamma rays. And that's what's usually being picked up on these personal decimeters. Now, there's 2 other kinds of particles that cannot penetrate my detector, and those are beta particles and alpha particles. They get into your body by breathing, or by taste, or through a cut in the skin. And they're what, when these guys are all bundled up in their suits, that's what they're being protected from beta particles and alpha particles. Now, these particles cause cellular damage only when they're inside you. Iodine, for instance, is selectively absorbed by your thyroid and causes damage directly to the thyroid. If iodine is outside you, it won't really cause radiation damage. The same with cesium. Cesium is exactly like, is absorbed by muscle. And it causes damage, especially to heart muscles in infants, but it causes muscle tumors. And strontium is another beta emitter, and it goes to your bone and can cause leukemia. Again, it's got through your skin, and it's right up against the marrow of your bone, which can cause a leukemia. And the last kind of radiation is an alpha particle. An alpha particle is the biggest and most massive of them all. And it usually comes from depleted uranium or from plutonium. And it's like a howitzer. It's really, really a powerful particle once it gets in your body. If you breathe in these alpha particles, if you breathe in the plutonium, when it decays away, it produces a cancer in your lung and is very, very damaging. Three more things before we go today is how radiation is measured. Well, they measure it in something called becquerels, and that's a disintegration per second. One disintegration per second is a becquerel. So I'd prefer to call it disintegrations per second. Now you'll see field measurements as far away from Fukushima as 30 or 40 miles, where a piece of paper laid on the field that's a meter by a meter, 3 feet by 3 feet, will pick up 900,000 disintegrations per second of beta particles, or of beta emitting particles, or of alpha emitting particles, or gamma emitting particles. Now, they don't know what that particle is, but they know that the piece of paper has that much on it. That's a lot. You'll also, so a becquerel, when you see that, is a disintegration every second. The other term is a sievert. You'll see 1 millisievert. Well, that's an indication of cellular damage, but the term that I'm used to is a millirem. 1 millisievert is 100 millirem. And so basically it's just 100 times bigger than a millirem. It's a measure of personal exposure. And the last term is half-life. What does that mean? Iodine has a half-life of 8 days. That means in 8 days, half of it's gone. In 16 days, only a quarter of it is left. In 24 days, an eighth is left. So every 8 days, whatever's there, a half disappears. Cesium, on the other hand, has got a 30-year half-life. So you got to wait 30 years for half of it to be gone, 60 years for only a quarter of it to be left, and 90 years for it to be an eighth left. The general rule of thumb is 10 half-lives and it's all gone. So for iodine, in the next 80 days, it will all be gone. But the cesium and the strontium will hang around for 300 years. The worst one of all is plutonium. And if it's released from the fuel, there hasn't been any detected yet, but if it's released from the fuel, it has a half-life of 24,000 years. And so therefore, it will hang around in the environment for 250,000 years. Well, that's it for today. And as I see more information on the web, I will try to post it. Thank you. Hi, I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds Associates. It's Tuesday, March 29th, 2011. Several things in the news have come up in the last several days that I wanted to share my impressions with you. They are the fact that the plutonium has been discovered on the Fukushima site. The second, that large quantities of very radioactive water have also been discovered on site. And the last is I wanted to give you my assessment of the condition of the nuclear cores in units 1, 2, and 3. First, the plutonium. Plutonium has been found on 5 different locations on site. And if you remember an earlier video I put together, plutonium is a difficult isotope to detect because it doesn't give off a gamma ray, it gives off an alpha particle. And that's not picked up by the traditional Geiger counters. That plus the high background on site makes it very difficult. So this had to be from soil samples. So 5 soil samples have turned up plutonium. If there's 5, there's more. And that's a great concern for me. Plutonium got its name from Pluto, the god of hell, and it's one of the more nasty isotopes that mankind has ever created. This is a gram. The dollar bill is roughly a gram. Well, if you cut that into 1 million pieces, you have a microgram, smaller than George Washington's eye. 1 microgram can cause a lethal cancer from plutonium. Now, I believe the plutonium is coming from the fuel pooling unit in Unit 4, although you can't rule out the other three reactors. Plutonium is evident in all the nuclear reactors. Unit 3 had some plutonium fuel, but all the reactors will have plutonium because the uranium-238 absorbs a neutron and becomes plutonium anyway. So it's in all four locations. The reason I think it's in the pool, though, is that it's scattered on the land on the site. And the most likely way to volatilize the plutonium would have been in a fire or a violent Zirk water reaction in the Unit 4 fuel pool. There's still a lot more data that needs to be developed, but again, if you found five samples, it's likely there'll be more on site. And a bigger concern to me is that if it's already in five locations on site, I think they'll find more off site. And its health consequences should not be downplayed by Tokyo Electric. The second thing is the fact that the enormous quantities of highly radioactive water have been found in trenches. These trenches are outside the nuclear containment. That means the containment isn't containing. I posted a link that's on our site as well that talks about how radioactive material can get out of the nuclear reactor and get through the containment and out into these trenches without a breach of the containment and without a breach of the nuclear reactor. It involves a leakage of a seal at the bottom of these nuclear reactors, and is quite plausible. And I urge you to take a look at it in detail. Well, what does this mean? The amount of water in those trenches is enormous. And it's very difficult to get demineralizers to remove that radioactivity in such high quantities. Basically, if the demineralizer absorbed that radioactivity, it would become so radioactively hot that personnel couldn't go near it. I've also had people say, well, why don't you take that water and pump it back in the nuclear reactor? Well, the radioactivity in that water is over 100 rem per hour. And basically that means that anybody who stands near it for 3 or 4 hours receives a lethal dose of radiation. So if you were to pump it back into the reactor, the pumps would become so radioactive that personnel couldn't operate the pumps. There's not much tankage space available on the site. They're trying to pump that water into the unit condensers. The condensers are not seismic and may not have withstood the earthquake and tsunami. So I think that water is leaking into the ocean. The quantity of radioactivity that's been detected in the ocean is an indication of an enormously large source of water, of radioactive water, hitting the ocean. I don't think it came from air releases. I think somewhere there is a leak into the ocean from this material. It's a troubling, really troubling scenario because the containment isn't containing. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about is the fact that the core damage appears to be minimized by Tokyo Electric. I had staff working for me when I was the vice president on Three Mile Island during the recovery, and I got to view the videos of the core damage at Three Mile Island. Now, we're putting one slide up here. It's very poor grain, but this is 1980s technology through a mini submarine. But you can see those thimbles are the nuclear fuel rods that have been totally destroyed. Now, at Three Mile Island, the reactor only was without water for about 10 hours, maybe 12. So for half a day, it didn't have water cooling it. And also, it only ran for 3 months before the accident, which means there's very little decay heat. At Fukushima, on the other hand, that reactor ran for 4 years, so the fuel had an enormous amount of decay heat in it. And the other piece is that it was uncooled for many days. So more decay heat plus very little cooling tells me that the damage inside that core is enormous. TMI lost one-third of its core. It wouldn't surprise me if there's 70 or 80% of the core that's been damaged. Now, what that means is it falls to the bottom of the reactor as slag, radioactive slag, molten slag at the bottom of the reactor. At very least, it's damaging those seals that I talk about. At worst, it's gradually eating its way through the nuclear reactor, and a meltdown is possible. Combine this with the salt water they've been added. You have hot water, incredible source of heat and salt. Corrosion of the vessel is likely. The net effect here is that I believe that the quantities of radiation that are going to continue to leak from that reactor into the containment, and now apparently out of the containment, are large. And frankly, I don't see how they're going to be stopped in the short term. Well, sorry, it's kind of a gloomy picture today. I will get back to you when I have more to tell you. Thank you. Hi, I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds Associates. Today is Thursday, March 31st, 2011. In the last 2 days, the Fukushima plant has kind of been stable but precarious, kind of like balancing on the edge of a cliff but not going over and not being pulled back either. I wanted to give you my opinion of a couple of the more significant pieces of information that have come out in the last 2 days. In broad terms, there's very large amounts of liquids still being released to the environment, very large amounts of gases still being released to the environment. And the other thing is that no one ever envisioned this type of recovery from an accident even a month ago before Fukushima happened. Well, let's talk about the liquid and gases releases. The New York Times is reporting that 200 tons of radioactive liquid are being poured into the nuclear reactors and the fuel pool at Fukushima every day. Well, where's it going? If it's going in, it's coming out. And it's coming out two ways. It's coming out as radioactive steam, and it's coming out as radioactive water. So if you're putting 200 tons in, 200 tons is coming out. In engineering terms, that's called feed and bleed. And what you're feeding in as clean water is bleeding out as radioactive steam and radioactive water. Well, there's some indications off-site that the releases are very large. The fuel's clearly damaged, significantly damaged, and of course the releases are going to be large with 200 tons of releases every day. That boils down to a couple things. The IAEA, that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, has found that 25 miles away from the reactor, there's been deposition of radioactive material to the tune of 2 million becquerels per square meter. Now, what does that mean? A square meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet, meter by a meter, and 2 megabecquerels is 2 million disintegrations every second is being deposited in roughly 3 feet by 3 feet. Now, that's well above what the IAEA would say you should evacuate if the levels are that high. So there are places out well beyond where the Japanese are evacuating that should be evacuated based on the deposition of radioactive materials nearby. To give you an example, at Chernobyl, the exclusion zone was 500,000 becquerels. This is four times higher than Chernobyl. Now, there are different isotopes, and some of these will decay away, and the Chernobyl ones are longer lived, but these are very serious concentrations of radioactivity being deposited on the ground from the radioactive steam coming out of the plant. The next thing is the water. We've seen incredibly high concentrations in the radioactive water in trenches on site. There's indications that the survey meters simply can't read high enough to measure the amount of radiation coming off the water. And another indication is what's in the ocean. Offshore radioactive readings in the ocean have gone up and are now over 3,000 times higher than the standards that are routinely expected. That's not coming from the air. The ocean's too big to be polluted by what's coming out of the airborne releases. It's clearly leaking from the trenches into the ocean. They haven't found the leak, but the only source of of quantities of radioactive material large enough to pollute the ocean has got to be leakage from these trenches. So with 200 tons of liquid going in and 200 tons of liquid going out, it's reasonable to expect that the ocean is going to be polluted because it's clearly leaking in. Now, there's one other interesting reading that was detected on site. There are several what's called heavy elements that are being detected on the ground. We talked about plutonium in the last video, but there are some other ones too, something called cerium, which is also one of these that doesn't easily go volatile. And that it's on the ground also indicates significant fuel damage, most likely from the fuel pool in Unit 4. Well, it's important to realize that this feed and bleed operation that's going on was never anticipated a month ago by anyone who ever planned to mitigate an accident. A month ago, the worst accident that was ever assumed was 1% of the fuel in one reactor melted. We've got 70% of the fuel in three reactors melting. A month ago, we thought the containment would leak at 0.5% per day. Now we know the containment is leaking much more than 0.5% per day. And a month ago, we thought that the radioactivity would go high up a stack, and in fact, we're finding that the stacks don't work and the radiation's on the ground. The net effect of this is that in the Fukushima vicinity, exposures are probably 500 to 1,000 times higher than anticipated in the accident analysis that was, you know, that was reasonable a month ago. Also, a month ago, no one ever envisioned the possibility of a fuel pool burning. That's still a possibility. Brookhaven National Labs back in 1997 did a study that said that the consequences of a fuel pool burning would be 137,000 fatalities from lung cancer. That's a serious study, and it's a number that we still need to be concerned about. Now, the difference between what's happened and what we thought would happen is that everyone believed that the containment would contain, and it's not. The plan was that what was in the reactor would get recirculated in the reactor, and none of that material would come out into the groundwater. And so these exposures are much, much higher as a result of what's happened to Fukushima. Well, thank you very much, and I'll get back to you as more develops. Hi, I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds Associates. It's Thursday, March 31st, and you'll probably notice that this is the second update of a day. Normally, I update you every other day. However, some disturbing video has shown up on Ustream that I wanted to talk to you about. First off, a little bit about my background. I used to be an executive in the nuclear industry, and one of the divisions I ran built nuclear fuel racks for boiling water reactors. So nuclear fuel racks are something that I know a little bit about. Nuclear fuel racks look like this. This is a square cans at the bottom of essentially a swimming pool, and each can is designed to handle one nuclear fuel bundle. And that's the glowing thing you see sliding into the can. Now, the wrapper around those cans, it has boron in it, and that's designed to prevent a nuclear chain reaction from occurring in the pool. You don't want a chain reaction to occur in the pool. That should occur in the reactor. Now, what happened at Fukushima was when the whole site lost power, at Fukushima 4, there was no reactor operating. All the fuel had been removed and was in the fuel pool. Now, normally the pools are cooled. However, they lost power, so there was no longer any cooling. It appears that the pools boiled dry. The roof blew off the building. That indicates that hydrogen was built up from something called the Zircaloy water reaction that had to occur at temperatures over 2200 degrees. Now, after that, the Fukushima staff has been attempting to pour water into that reactor. And you can see in this picture that up the side of the building is a hydraulic device. It's actually designed for pumping concrete. That's pumping water up and over the roof and pouring water into the nuclear fuel pool. Well, this picture is undated, but when it was taken, it clearly shows that there's no water in the pool. Now, if you look, there's a green, long green device, and that's the refueling bridge. Normally, that glides along on rails above the pool, and the pool is that crystal clear water that you normally are used to seeing. Well, after the explosion, it has collapsed and is lying in the pool. Now, between seconds 33 and 37 on this video, you can see little boxes. And the little boxes are just to the left of that green bridge. The boxes are in air. Those boxes are the top of nuclear fuel racks. They're supposed to be under 30 feet of water. They're not. Now, what that means to me is a couple things. First off, the top of the nuclear fuel is exposed. Perhaps all the nuclear fuel is exposed, but certainly the top is. You can see steam coming up, but not from the top of the fuel. Down further in the cavity, there's steam coming up. So the water that they're spraying in is hitting the nuclear fuel and creating steam, but it's not filling that swimming pool. Now, the water has two purposes, cooling, but also shielding. So that means that the nuclear fuel is unshielded. That emits gamma rays, and the gamma rays go up into the sky, bounce off of air molecules through something called sky shine, and rain back down on the site as a background radiation that's much higher than normal. That makes work on site really difficult, and it makes work on that refueling pool almost lethal. Now, the other thing it means to me is that the nuclear fuel itself is extraordinarily hot, and the plutonium inside can become volatile. Now, I spoke yesterday in the earlier update about cerium being discovered off-site and plutonium being discovered. And the fact that the nuclear fuel pool does not have water in it, to me, indicates that it might be a clean path for those heavy elements to be escaping from the building and being discovered off-site. Now, I would recommend, based on this, that the evacuation zones should be pushed back further because of these heavy elements being released, as well as the cesium that was also in those racks. It does have some serious consequences. As this situation develops and perhaps more clear pictures are available, I'll update you again. Thanks again. Hi, I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds Associates, and it's Sunday, April 3rd. A couple of videos ago, I talked to you about the types of radiation, and I talked about gamma rays, alpha particles, and beta particles. Well, there's one more type, and that's called a neutron, that I need to talk about today. When a uranium atom splits, it gives off two heavy pieces called daughter products, but it also gives off a couple of neutrons. Those neutrons hit the next uranium atom and cause it to split, and then we get a chain reaction. So when you see neutrons, that's an indication that a chain reaction is occurring inside a nuclear reactor. That's how you determine that it really is a chain reaction. Well, some data over the last couple of days and weeks have come up that indicate that one of the reactors at Fukushima may still be experiencing a chain reaction. First off, there was a report in one of the English-Japanese papers that discussed neutron bursts being detected about a mile away from the reactor. Now, that got my curiosity because when I was a startup engineer back in 1974 on Millstone 2, we had neutron problems, and we were actually detecting neutrons at the guard shed at the fence boundary. So I know that nuclear reactors can emit neutrons, and they travel a long way. In and of itself, that report wasn't enough, and it was the only paper that covered it. Well, this week, a prestigious scientific paper came out, and it talked about the discovery of a strange isotope called chlorine-38. Chlorine-38 doesn't exist in nature, and it comes from chlorine-37 absorbing a neutron. Well, chlorine 37 is in seawater, and seawater is inside the nuclear reactors. So this paper postulated that we had a chain reaction going on in one of the Fukushima reactors, and it was turning salt water into chlorine 38. Again, it wasn't definitive. Well, on April 1st, TEPCO came out with its own report, and in it had a curious table. The table indicates that for unit 1, there's an isotope called tellurium 129, and that isotope has a 70-minute half-life. Well, that can only exist if there had been a fission in the last half day, because it would have all decayed away otherwise. So the report indicated to me really quickly that, whoa, something's going on in unit 1. And I read the report a little further down, and it also indicated high levels of iodine-131. In fact, the iodine levels in unit 1 are 10 times higher than they are in units 2 and 3. Now, if they all shut down at the same time, that can't happen. So where's the iodine coming from? Where's the tellurium coming from? Where's the chlorine coming from? And where did those neutron bursts come from? I think Unit 1 has a part of its reactor core that is still undergoing periodic nuclear fissions. We call that an inadvertent criticality, meaning we didn't really plan on this happening, but it is. Now, what that means is that, one, extra heat is being generated. Remember I talked about 95% of the heat came from fission and 5% from the daughter products? Well, if fission is occurring, there's a lot more heat in Unit 1 than just from its daughter products. The other thing is a lot more radiation, especially iodine, might be generated. And the last thing, and really the most important thing, is that a lot of neutrons are being generated. Neutrons are incredibly difficult to measure and could be exposing the personnel on that site to doses that they're not aware of. Well, I want to make clear what I am saying and what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that Unit 1 is running at full power, but what I am saying is that a portion of the core is periodically turning itself on without human intervention. How can that happen? Well, as they flood the reactor with water, the chain reaction begins. The chain reaction creates heat, boils off the water, and the chain reaction stops. They flood the reactor, chain reaction begins, boils off the water, stops. So it's possible that a portion of Unit 1's core is turning itself on and off and exposing personnel to neutrons that the dosimeters are not detecting. What this means for TEPCO is that they have to add boron to the water that's going into Unit 1 to stop that chain reaction from occurring. Well, thank you very much. If I hear any more, I will pass it on to you through these videos. Thanks.